Welcome into another edition of the Dayton and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick. Dan is on the line with me. Dan, it's been about a week since we talked. Xavier has picked up a couple big wins since then, got themselves back on track, the latest being Chris Mack's 203rd win against St. John's on Wednesday night at the Cintas Center. Where do you want to start here?
Well, I guess where I want to start is I just want to describe a tableau to you last night and then give a little public service announcement to our listenership. And that's that last night, both my kids, as you know, I got a 4 and a 2-year-old. They were both sick. They had thrown up. They were both done throwing up. So my wife is sitting on the couch with both kids, like, on each knee and, like, a big mixing bowl in her lap just in case they had another issue. And I'm sitting on the other couch, you know, screwing around on my phone, whatever. My son sort of sits up and starts barfing into the bowl. My daughter looks at him, and she starts barfing into the same bowl. And my wife looks at me with this look of utter panic. And, like, I didn't know whether to laugh, which would have been a bad idea, pull my phone out and start taking a video, which would have been probably a worse idea. And so what I ended up doing is sort of that classic, like, dad sort of impotent, how can I help type thing, where I know that I can't really help. So I say all this as preface. To you young folks out there, Rick, or other listeners who are younger, the few of you there are, think about your reproductive choices and ask yourself, is this what I want to be? The second key issue that I want to talk about is it involves you, because I think we need to get down, we need to tell the truth here. I mean, this is a time where it's like the time of fake news, and there was an incident that happened on local news this week that I think we need to unpack a little bit. And
it needs to be addressed.
Is Fartgazi. So I want you to begin with the beginning, and maybe you can drop the audio into this podcast. I don't know if you want to spend that much time on it, but can you explain exactly what happened and what this ridiculous, I'm going to say gaslighting, and I know it's a terrible pun, but this terrible gaslighting we're getting from certain corners of the Cincinnati media.
So John London, a respected journalist in our town, reporter for Channel 5, was doing a live drive, which is essentially, you know, they show them in the truck driving around saying, oh, there's salt on the frickin' road still. They've been cleared off for 8 hours. Back to you in the studio. Basically, that's what he was supposed to do. When you do a live shot, there's always like a little delay between the time, you know, they send it to you and you hear it in your ear and the video actually takes and everything. So you don't always know exactly when you're coming on. And essentially what happened is, I don't think John quite knew he was on camera yet. He had one coming on. He sort of leaned in his seat a little bit and let out one of the loudest farts, most clear as day farts I've ever heard in my life.
John London is in the car right now, live drive 5. John, where are you right now? What are you seeing?
We're northbound 75, Mike, in the...
Right as he's about to do his live shot, he goes through with his live shot, does it like the professional that he is. It was flawless. I don't think it's something he should be ridiculed or made fun of for. I think he should be honored for being the pro that he is, but also respected for what a genuinely amazing fart noise he can make with his ass cheeks.
Now, from what I understand, there's been some controversy. Some of your colleagues in the local media are saying that it wasn't, in fact, an emission of gas.
And see, here's the thing. I went into this, I was told about it by a coworker whose mother had sent it to her, and I went into it saying, look, guys, no way it's a fart. It's got to be something else, right? Like, he moved around in his seat. There's someone rustling in the background. His driver did something, whatever. I was expecting it to be anything but a fart. But when you hear it, it is so clearly a fart. It couldn't be anything other than a fart after you hear it. There's no doubt that it is a fart. And so a young lady who I have a lot of respect for at Channel 5 tried to tell me that it was not a fart, and she heard it clear on their little playback system at their studio and was trying to tell me it was not a fart. And so her excuse was, it was him moving on a leather seat. Well, me being the fart truther that I am, talked to sources, figured I was a little skeptical because, let's be honest, there's not a whole lot of money in local news right now. So spending for leather seats and a live truck, not likely. I found out, not true. They have cloth seats. So we're back to a fart. I mean, the man farted. That, and it's I'm not trying to bring him down for it. Again, I'm trying to honor him and show him the respect he deserves, but he farted. And I don't understand why no one at Channel 5 will just ask him.
Do you, I mean, I have a great deal of respect for him as well, but a true pro like John Lomax would never pass wind on set.
Well, he might, but he would own up to it. He would immediately make a joke about it and be like, look, folks, the black ice on the road is silent but deadly. The fart I just let out was clearly not.
All right, we should probably talk about Xavier basketball for the 8 people still listening to this.
You guys are welcome. So,
if this was the Jim Rome show, someone would press, like, the buzzer, I think, for, like, 30 seconds. So a good week for the Musketeers, obviously beating Creighton and then St. John's in a two-game homestand, right at the ship a little bit after another unfortunate incident at Villanova. Rick, I guess when I think about, and I want to focus on the St. John's game, because I know you guys have recorded the Skinny podcast a couple of times. You guys broke down Creighton pretty well last week. But in terms of the St. John's game, I think for a lot of fans, they look at it and they say, wow, Xavier's struggling badly with a lower-tier Big East team at home. It's the second time it's happened in 3 weeks. We know they've had some struggles at home against similar-level teams. Is this something to be concerned about? And what I go back to is what you've written in some detail about kind of the mentality and the character of this team. And I was wondering if you could kind of go back over, you know, we're recapitulating some information that was in one of your columns, but I think it's an interesting thing to look at in terms of how this team plays.
Yeah, so my theory has kind of always been about this group of guys, and it goes back to when you kind of had, like, Miles Davis emerging as a leader on the team and Trayvon becoming, even as a sophomore, kind of one of the go-to players. Those guys were always super confident individuals, also introverts who kind of stuck to themselves a little bit. Like, they're friendly, they're pretty close-knit in terms of being friends and everything, but they are not guys who challenge their teammates in practice in the way like a C.J. Anderson would. Everyone looks back when they think of great leaders at Xavier, they think of a guy like C.J. Anderson who would literally scare you in the locker room at halftime into defending harder or being tougher or rebounding better or doing whatever you needed. This group of leaders is not that way at all. They aren't going to do that. They're all calm. They're all relaxed. They all believe, yeah, we got down 15 points in that first half against a team who stinks, but that team stinks and we're really good and we'll go on a 20-0 run. That's kind of just their mindset. And I think at times it leads to a lack of urgency. And it's also the reason the team can earn an 11 seed after losing 6 straight games in the Big East Conference last year and still make a run to the Elite Eight. Because all along last year, they never lost faith. They never got rattled. They were like, Trayvon's hurt. We lost Edmund. We'll figure it out. We're good. And that's how they approach it. Like, they never wavered. They came into practice every day as the same team, worked the same way, had the same level of confidence. So that's sort of been my theory with this group of leaders, is that they are prone to playing down to their competition a little too often. I will also say, I think the St. John's game is a little bit different, because I think St. John's gives them matchup problems with their guards. And, you know, Chris Mack said it after the game. He's like, it is what it is. We don't deal well with small, quick guards. We understand that. You understand that. Everyone knows it. It's just a fact. We have to figure some things out when we play teams with those types of players, and they usually get off. We just have to make it as tough as possible.
Can I ask a follow-up question on that? Why specifically do you think that this team struggles so badly with small, quick guards?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that when they're defending ball screens on the perimeter, they're going to switch their wings, you know, along with their guards. Basically 1 through 3 or 1 through 4 quite often when they have Kaiser or Najee or, well, Najee's only playing the 3, but Trayvon at the 4, they're going to be switching everything 1 through 4. And Trayvon and JP are slow-footed. I mean, they're not quick laterally. And in addition to that, they're also your helpers in the gap. And if they're not quick laterally, well, you don't have quick help. So if you're Quentin or someone else and you get beat, well, there's not a lot you can do about it at that point. So I think that's the biggest reason. But I also think, like, there's maybe some flaws in this defense or some weaknesses in this defense that we've seen over the years, because it seems like this isn't the first time Xavier's struggled with small, quick guards. You know, I think they've had issues with that in the past. So I think ball screens in general, teams that use ball screens and have quick guards, give the pack line defense and the way Xavier defends ball screens some trouble. So that would be my best answer.
Thinking about the first half of this game, one of the common themes that you and I have talked about, I think even before we started recording the show, was that Chris Mack's teams tended to take less threes than we thought they should, given their personnel and the way basketball has moved. And here you have a first half of the game against St. John's where Xavier did not make a two-point basket until 13 minutes into the game, but shot 14 for 26 from three and hit 9 of them in the first half. So was that just a matter of Xavier taking what the defense gave them, or was there something more, or are we seeing maybe an evolution in Xavier's style toward being more aggressive from the perimeter?
No, it's strictly the former, because Chris Mack is always saying, you know, when we ask him about shot selection or anything like that after games, he says the same thing every time. I want my players to do what the game tells them. He doesn't get mad at his guys if he feels like they're taking good open shots that they can make. You know, I mean, he doesn't want Sean O'Mara and Tyreek Jones firing up threes, obviously, but if it's the right guys getting good looks within the offense, he wants them to take those looks. And St. John's just doesn't guard the perimeter. They don't care who it is. Like, they'll leave Trayvon wide open from three, as they did multiple times in that game. So he had no problem with them jacking up a bunch of threes. And quite honestly, like, I think it's a strategy they should use a little more often. I think sometimes when they get bogged down offensively, they should just open it up and start gunning a little bit more from the outside. But that's not really the way Chris plays things. He, like I said, he truly wants his guys to do what the defense tells them, stick to their game plan. If they feel they've got an advantage inside, then they're going to throw it inside. If they feel like their guards can get into the lane off ball screens and out quick some teams, they're going to do that. But in this game, it was St. John's just isn't going to guard a lot of our shooters, so we're going to jack a bunch of threes.
So Xavier gets into halftime up 42-34, and then St. John's goes through a long period at the beginning of the second half where they were just hitting shots and executing offensively at a high level. I think they hit 12 of their first 13 field goal attempts in the second half. Xavier couldn't get a stop. Chris cycled through, I think, three different defenses during that period, and X just could not get a stop during that period. And it also, and for a while, X was trading buckets pretty effectively, but after a while, their offense kind of got on track, too. And so, first of all, I want to ask you the defensive issues first. Do you think this was a matter of Xavier struggling on defense, or was it just St. John's hitting tough shot after tough shot?
I think it was both. I don't think Xavier looked like they were completely locked in or totally focused, but St. John's was hitting some really difficult shots, and not to mention, even if you're shooting nothing but wide open shots, going 11 for 12 or 12 for 13 or whatever it was to start the half is impressive, even if they're all wide open looks. So you definitely got to tip your cap to St. John's for what they were doing offensively, and you know, Justin Simon was playing out of his mind. He was excellent in that game, which I expected him to give Xavier some trouble. I didn't think he was going to score 28 points, obviously. So that certainly gave him a boost. But I think it was a little bit of a combination of the two, Dan, to answer your question.
Offensively, when Xavier struggled in the second half, it seemed to me, and you know, I don't break down the tape like you do, but it seems like Xavier's offense, when they get into the half-court offense, runs best when they at least take a deep breath and work the ball inside and get a paint touch. And it seemed like they went away from that for about a 5 or 6 minute period. And I don't know if it was Xavier trying to match St. John's pace, because St. John's, even though they don't maybe, even when you look at maybe their tempo statistics, they don't have that many possessions in a game, but they definitely play offensively very crisply, and they try to move the ball quickly, and they've got guys that really have that lateral quickness and straight line quickness to try and get around you. And I thought Xavier they got sped up a little bit too much, and they got kind of taken out of their game, which I kind of feel like was the same thing that happened in the first half against DePaul, when DePaul made it a super hectic game and Xavier tried to play that way and maybe went away from things that they were good at. Was that the sense you got, and how do you think they were able to pull out of that and make the run that eventually won the game?
I wouldn't say you're wrong specifically in this game, in the St. John's game. And part of that is because of how well Karim Cantor is playing right now, that I would kind of agree. When he's on the court, a lot of times he should probably be getting touches because of even if he's not scoring, he's skilled offensively and can pass the ball. So he can set guys up and create plays for his teammates too. But to me, I kind of see it the other way when I watch Xavier play, which is when their offense bogs down and they get untracked, I tend to think they get too much into trying to force the ball into the post and play through their bigs. I think what they need to do more of when that happens is speed things up, get a little more pace going, and get the ball moving side to side. Get the defense moving through multiple rotations, because I think sometimes they just try to attack it too straightforward, like dribble up, you know, throw that ball into the high post and then look directly into the post, and then it's not there. They back it out and they maybe go one ball screen, or, you know, kind of looks like UC's offense at times when they do that. And I think they lose their pace, and their wings and guards aren't involved enough in the offense, so they kind of lose their rhythm as well. I think Xavier's at their best when the ball's swinging side to side, going off multiple ball screens, getting the defense moving, and then whether you finish with a look into the post to get the ball into the bigs, or one of your talented wings or guards taking a shot and making a play, it doesn't really matter. I just think when they slow down, that's what they need to get back to, is moving the ball from side to side more.
You referenced Karim Cantor. He started both home games this week, had huge games in both. I believe he had 24 against St. John's. Four straight games in double digits. He's emerged as probably the best big man on the team, and arguably in terms from a statistical, especially from efficiency perspective, maybe the most effective offensive player on the team. We knew coming in that he was going to be an option for them. But I think when we talked about him, it was less about his ability to score inside, but his ability to stretch the floor. And that really, although he is shooting a decent percentage on threes, he's not taking that many.
No.
And he's doing most of his damage in the paint, maybe putting a dribble on the floor and getting around his man. I mean, what are you seeing from him that explains this leap in productivity we've seen?
Shrug emoji? Like, Dan, I really don't know. Mike Pegues is really good as a big man's coach. We know that. I don't know if he's this good. Like, I don't know if we can put all the credit from his jump for, you know, playing 19 minutes a game at Green Bay and being effective a decent amount of the time, but also being really inconsistent, to being one of the best big men in the Big East. It's really impressive. And Dan, you hit the nail on the head. I thought he would be a guy who stretched the floor, gave them a shooter in the corner, you know, kind of a guy that the defense might forget about, and he'd burn you with an open look or two. I also thought he wouldn't be a very good rebounder, thought he might be a little soft, thought he'd be a really poor defender. He's been better defensively than we expected, without question. I thought Chad kind of brought up... Go ahead, sorry.
And I think rebounding-wise, I think has been the biggest thing, because he's been a very strong, especially in the defensive glass. He just has... He's good fundamentals and good footwork, and he doesn't often get beat to a defensive rebound when Xavier's in man.
Yeah, and that's you nailed it. I mean, that's exactly what I was going to say, Dan. You think about the fact that he doesn't even play, you know, he doesn't even average more than like 20 minutes a game. I'm not looking at the stats right now, but for most of the year, he's been under 20 minutes a game. He might be over it now because he's played a little more the last few, and he's still top 10 in the Big East in total rebounds. No one expected that out of Karim Cantor coming into the season, and his toughness on the glass has been a big surprise, and he does it at both ends.
Yeah, there's two other players, sort of player issues I wanted to talk about before we move on to Seton Hall game. The first one, this may be a yes or no question, but is Trayvon Bullitt back now?
Yes. Okay. Do you think so?
Next one. Yes. Okay. I think against Creighton, there were signs of it. Just a little bit more confidence. And I think the extended period of time in that Creighton game where Xavier was up 20, 25 points early in the second half, and those guys were able to be out there and just kind of play for a couple of minutes without a whole lot of pressure on him, I think that might help Trayvon, just to kind of get the weight off his shoulders and to allow him to get back into a rhythm. But, yeah, against St. John's, he was hitting the mid-range shot. He was driving to the basket when it was open for him. He had a nice and one, I think toward the end of the first half, obviously hit a couple threes. So I don't know that he's back to his, like, NCAA tournament last year or at UC best, but that's a pretty high bar to meet. And he certainly doesn't look like a guy whose struggles are going to impede Xavier from being able to compete in some of the tough tests they have coming up.
Yeah.
The last thing I want to talk about was point guard play, because obviously there were some issues against St. John's, and partially that's because of that St. John's game. They love to run. It looked like kind of a 1-2-2 press. They were effective in turning Xavier over, and it wasn't just Quentin and Paul, for the record. I mean, JP had a bad turnover in the backcourt late. They had some dumb passes, but it does look like Quentin Gooden's struggles are continuing, and that seems like something that's got to be fixed, because this league, it's going to be very tough for Xavier, especially on the road, to compete without a little bit more steadiness at the point guard.
Well, yeah, but I think if you go back to the Creighton game, he didn't finish some shots around the rim, but he was 6-2, you know, in terms of assists and turnovers. So he's been up and down at times with taking care of the ball and having the issues with turnovers. Now, granted, Creighton's not a team who tries to turn you over. They play a pack line defense like Xavier does, so that can be part of it, obviously. But you need Quentin to be better than he was against St. John's. There's no question about it. I'm kind of in the camp of Quentin Gooden taking care of the basketball isn't going to be what brings this Xavier team down. I don't think that's going to be an issue in big games. I mean, you think back to last year as a freshman getting thrown into the fire, he was able to perform admirably in terms of taking care of the ball and getting Xavier into their offense in the postseason. I just don't see that being a big deal. I think he's improved as a sophomore. There's areas he has to get better. He certainly has to play with more confidence at times, but over the long haul, I think these are blips on the radar and not going to be a big issue.
The officiating in that game was terrible, the St. John's game. Absolutely atrocious. Starting from 8 seconds into the game. We'll move on. So Seton Hall, 230, probably, I think if you were to chart out Xavier's 18 Big East games, this would be the second and at worst the third toughest game on the schedule. Would you agree with that?
No, absolutely the second toughest. I don't see any way it's not.
I think maybe you could argue Villanova at home is tougher at this point. But
That makes sense. I guess I was thinking team-wise, you know, not. But yeah, that's a good point.
But yeah, so and low key, this has been a place that where Xavier's gotten dominated since joining the Big East. I mean, everyone knows about Xavier's struggles at Villanova, getting blown out every time they go out there. Seemingly, well, no, not seemingly. That's actually what happened. But Seton Hall, they've been uncompetitive in a couple games and had a couple games against Seton Hall teams that probably weren't as good as Xavier that they just haven't been able to figure out. There have been some. Perhaps some mitigating factors at times. I mean, obviously, last year when they played at Seton Hall, they didn't have Trayvon Blewett. 3 years ago when they played at Seton Hall, it was a game where Matt Stainbrook was injured in the first half, and Xavier kind of had to put it together with baling wire for the rest of the day. But it's a place Xavier has not been successful. What's your sense of why that is, or if there is an overarching issue that Xavier has with Seton Hall style?
Well, I think, for one, Seton Hall has had some pretty good teams over that time period. For two, they've usually had matchup problems for Xavier. I mean, you think back to like Isaiah Whitehead just giving Miles Davis for certain. Was it D or someone else at the time that was running the point? But I just remember Xavier's guards seeming too small, not strong enough, not athletic enough to stick with Isaiah Whitehead and the rest of that Seton Hall team. And this Seton Hall team will give Xavier some trouble too. There's also, I think, Kevin Willard's system gives Xavier trouble, because you remember when we were talking to Chris during the podcast at Dana's this summer, the question was asked if he could have any Big East coach his team for a game, who would it be? And he said Kevin Willard. And you would think, you know, he would defer to a coach that gives him trouble. So my guess is he has some respect for the way Willard does things and the system that he runs. Obviously, it's a lot of ball screens. You know, Desi Rodriguez and Kadeen Carrington both create off of a lot of ball screens. Desi draws a ton of fouls. They both can shoot from three. Miles Powell is an excellent spot-up shooter who's really improved as a creator off the bounce as well. So they've got some talented guards. And then, oh yeah, they have the best big man in the conference in Angel Delgado. So it's going to be a difficult game. Xavier's catching them at the wrong time because they just got their brains beat in at Creighton, and as we talked about before we were coming on the podcast, Willard made the odd decision to start beef with one of his players for unknown reasons, but it's always seemed to work out for them in the past. Dysfunction has kind of been what gets them going. So I have a feeling this is going to be a very difficult game for Xavier to win.
Yeah, I mean, if this doesn't work, Willard's going to bring Jaren Cena back and then kick him off the team again. I have to assume.
It worked last time.
But it's such a bizarre situation because you have Willard essentially saying he plays Desi, what, 5 or 6 minutes against Creighton, and essentially says in the press conference afterwards, I looked at his face and he didn't want to be out there. And it's like, what? How does that make any sense? So it almost seems like the beef starts just from Kevin Willard being pissed off that his team is getting run out of the gym in Omaha, which, by the way, that happens to pretty much everybody. So yeah. It's like...
Well, then Desi fired off a tweet after the game, too, right, saying that it was hilarious to say that he didn't want to be out there.
So, I mean, who knows what the fallout of this is. There's been no, like... I mean, he's not suspended. There's no indication that he's going to be not available or limited availability on Saturday. Maybe he doesn't start or something like that. But yeah, so that's, I guess, a little bit of the subplot there. How do you see this game going, Rick?
Again, I just think it's going to be really difficult for Xavier to win this game on the road. But what we have seen from this Xavier team is they seem to, obviously the Villanova game notwithstanding, they seem to rise to the occasion for big games. So I do think they will be competitive. I do think they will give a good effort. Seton Hall's a good team. Like Xavier will be the underdog going into this game in Vegas. I would almost guarantee that. Now, it might be close. It might be like 1.5, 2, something like that in terms of the line. But my guess is Xavier will be the underdog. So it's not a game Xavier is expected to win to begin with. And just the fact that Seton Hall is coming off that embarrassing loss at Creighton makes me think it's going to be a tough day for Xavier to pull off the dub.
I agree with you. I don't think the smart money would be on Xavier, but you know, this is one of those games that if Xavier wants to make a run at winning this conference, it's unlikely as it seems that Villanova would lose more than maybe one or two more games, but as unlikely as it seems, if they are going to make a run for that, or if they want to finish second, or if they are to finish second, this is a game that if you can steal, takes you a long, long way toward doing that, because the way the Big East schedule has been backloaded this season, all of Xavier's quote-unquote easy road games, if such a thing exists, are pushed back to the very end of the schedule. So, you know, you're going to see them play at Seton Hall, and you're going to see them play at Creighton, you're going to see them play at Butler before they play those tees. Well, I guess the St. John's game is mixed in, but X is going to need to get one of these games. They're going to have to win one of these tilts, to quote Jim Ozarski, against a Seton Hall or a Creighton or a Butler, I think, to really put themselves in solid spot for a high NCAA tournament seed.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I also think, I mean, this is an opportunity to make a statement. This is a game that will be on people's radar. Seton Hall is legitimately good, and I think they have the respect of people around the country. So, yeah, if you go in and you win this one on the road, I think it means something. I think it's kind of a splash game that turns some heads, but I don't necessarily expect that to happen.
Right. Okay, moving on. You guys on the Skinny podcast talked at length about Chris Mack's sort of position in the Xavier annals. He obviously takes over the all-time winningest coach with his 203rd win.
Yes.
Is that right?
Correct.
Eclipsing the record set by his coach, Pete Gillen. So, I mean, what else, anything else you want to talk about as far as this goes? I mean, it's been discussed at great length. That's obviously something that Chris has no interest in talking about, but it certainly is a milestone for the program and for his career.
Yeah, and I don't think it's as much about, you know, having that record or that specific win, but when you get to a moment like that and you hit that milestone, it's one of those times where people do reflect on, you know, what you've meant to the program and sort of your career at that point, because it has been 9 years now. You know, I mean, this is his ninth season. It's kind of hard to believe that we're closing in on a decade of Chris Mack, and because every year it's felt like, is he going to stay or is he going to go, or what jobs is he going to be up for? People are always saying, is he going to stay? Is he going to stay? And it's like, well, now we're a decade in, you know, like, I mean, we're closing in on that number. So Chris Mack is, Mo Egger hit it on the head. He is probably the most relatable big time sports figure you'll see. And in a town like Cincinnati, he is legitimately a big time personality that is hugely popular. He's known wherever he goes out, whenever he goes out. And he's just handled himself so well, I think, in the public eye, that it's made it really easy for people to root for Xavier. I think it's also raised the national profile of Xavier because people like talking about Chris Mack. They like, you know, he gives good quotes. Media members like him. So I think in addition to all the winning and all the success he's had, he's just kind of been a really easy coach to root for if you're a fan, or even if you're not a fan and just someone in the city. So it was a pretty cool moment. I enjoyed kind of reflecting on it and writing about it. What was your kind of take on what we talked about in terms of the ranking the coaches since Bob Stack? Did you agree with any of that, or did you care about it at all?
I haven't listened to it yet.
Oh, okay. Then never mind. I'm sorry for assuming.
No, it's okay. No, but I do recommend that everybody out there, if they haven't read your column about the post-game, the St. John's game, about Chris, to do so, because I think it lays out a lot of the things that you just talked about. But I guess as I look back, it's, you know, obviously Chris had no head coaching experience when he came to Xavier, and I think there was a little bit of feeling when Sean Miller left that maybe Xavier was at a point where they would be better off bringing in an experienced head coach that maybe had some success elsewhere, in the same way that they brought in Thad Matta. But obviously it's worked out wonderfully. And you know, I think the thing about Chris that I like the best is the fact that I know for a fact that he takes his job deadly seriously, but he doesn't seem to take himself that seriously. He has a, you know, kind of a self-effacing, self-deprecatory sense of humor that I think really plays well and really is easy to, as you say, root for and relate to. And I think some of that might be the fact that, you know, his career had ups and downs, obviously. You know, he struggled with terrible injury. He was the Cincinnati Post High School Player of the Year when he was at St. X, was recruited by a lot of schools in sort of Xavier's weight class at the time, goes to Evansville. And then when he came back had issues with his coach there, had all those injury issues at Xavier that really wrecked what could have been a really promising career. And then, you know, after that, after maybe a year of pro ball, he goes and gets a regular job for a while. So I think he just brings a different background to the coaching profession than a lot of guys do. And obviously he relates to his players really well. Obviously he relates to the fans, he relates to the media really well. And it's tough to say at this point that higher than anything but a slam dunk. Obviously, how much longer he'll be here, maybe is up in the air, depending on how things go with Louisville and some of the other high-profile jobs that are out there. But you would certainly have to say that this Chris Mack era at Xavier has been the most successful tenure of any coach that's come through Victory Parkway.
Yeah, and I think one thing that's kind of underrated about all this that I did mention in the article, but it's probably, you know, just a footnote, is what his personality and the respect he's garnered around the coaching community has meant for building up his assistants. Right now you have a guy in Travis Steele who one would have to assume he's the heavy favorite to take over if Chris were to leave. And if he doesn't take over at Xavier, I think most people expect him to be a successful head coach wherever he goes instead. And that's probably sooner than later when he gets his own program. Luke Murray was already getting interviews this offseason, interviewed for the Dayton job as a head coach. I think he's seen as a very good recruiter and a guy who is going to run his own program at some point. And then you've got Mike Pegues, who is maybe the best big man's coach in the entire country and respected as such by pretty much anyone you can talk to around the country in the coaching community or just people who are around the game. People know Mike Pegues, they respect Mike Pegues, and quite honestly, if Mike Pegues really wanted to be a head coach right now, he probably already could be as well. And if he decides he wants to do that in the future and really pursues that option, he'll have opportunities to do so. So even if Chris Mack leaves, I mean, some of these guys could go with them, whatever, but Xavier is in a really good place in terms of being a destination for not only head coaches, but also assistant coaches to come and build up their career.
Yeah, and so I think that your column really hit all the high points that I would say. And at this point, the only thing left is to, the last set of goals, I guess, for this program at this point that Chris is taking aim at is can you win the Big East and can you get to the Final Four? And this is a team that, I mean, it's not, I don't know that they're flawless, but this is a team that could achieve one or both of those things if some breaks fall their way. So I think you kind of said it all in your column and some of the comments you just made. Anything else you want to discuss before we adjourn today?
No, not really. Do you
live in perpetual fear of being named in Gary Parish's poll attacks column?
I do not, because I do not get to vote in the poll. But I think you brought up a good point. This was off air. We were talking about it over text messaging. You brought up a good point that he probably would be better off only writing the article when there's egregious errors and something really ridiculous to kind of ridicule. But at the same time, I totally agree with him that he's not the one at fault for pointing out, hey, people are being really lazy and not doing their jobs. And the fact that there are bad people on Twitter that are then running with that and pointing it out and criticizing these people and calling them all types of terrible names and making them not want to vote anymore, that's not Gary's fault. That's people on Twitter's fault. And I never think you should let idiots and the lowest common denominator dictate what type of content you make. It's a good piece of content. It's a worthy piece of content because you really shouldn't have these idiots voting when they're not taking their time to do it and then admitting, I just threw it together because I didn't have time, so I didn't look. So I voted for Georgetown in the top 25 or whatever this week. Like,
right.
This does matter. The top 25 poll is cited in everything. It very much shapes the national perception of these teams. There's no denying that. It's we either need to do away with citing it or people need to take it seriously. I'd be much happier if there was just a committee of, like, Rob Doster and Barstool Riggs and, you know, any of the national columns, Gary Parish, even Mike DeCourcy, any of the national college basketball columnists, Brian Snow, Evan Daniels, you can throw them in the mix. Any of those guys who really pay attention to the full landscape in the entire country, I don't think there need to be college beat writers voting in this poll because they just probably don't have the time, and that's fine, but also just don't really care to keep up with the rest of the country. They kind of keep up with their own conference, and that's a problem.
Well, I think that back in the day, the reason that you have the Associated Press poll for both football and basketball was because there wasn't anybody really keeping track of the sport from a national perspective. And by bringing together various regions and kind of merging them together, you got a better picture of what was happening nationwide. That's definitely true in football. That's definitely the way it started in football. But, you know, I think the points you made, I think, are pretty much accurate. I don't read poll attacks every week, but there have definitely been times where I've read poll attacks and I've been like, come on, Gary. Just because one team beat another team head-to-head doesn't mean that the team that won that head-to-head game necessarily has a better resume. And sometimes I think before you just rip somebody up and down in a hot take column, you should maybe drop them an email and say, hey, can you explain why you did this? Because maybe they have a reason. Maybe that reason is stupid. But sometimes I think it's just nitpicky. And I think sometimes his own daily top 25 ranking is just as susceptible to minor flaws like that. But I totally get the idea of calling out voters who just completely do ridiculous things and don't take the process seriously and clearly don't keep up with the game from a nationwide basis. I think that those people should, hopefully the outcome of this minor kerfluffle is the people who aren't willing to put in that time drop off the voting panel and clear space for those that do. Obviously, I don't condone the issue that I had, though, was I do kind of get the idea from this one reporter, this female reporter, saying, look, every time he features me in this, I just get dozens and dozens of sexist and, like, horrible tweets and reactions on social media, and it's just terrible. And I get that. I mean, we both know Shannon Russell pretty well, or at least from a professional standpoint, and God knows she gets worse grief on social media than any male reporter would. So I get that. I guess I kind of see where everybody's coming from here. I guess if I was Gary, I'd just start limiting it to when people do things that are really stupid and worthy of being called out, instead of trying to do it every single week.
Yeah, that's very fair. Again, I just don't think you can blame idiots on Twitter making sexist or racist comments to reporters on something that someone else writes that is valid.
You know, yeah, that's fair. I mean,
just because you point it out doesn't mean it gives someone else the right to be a deplorable human being. That's not how this works. And I don't, like, I had people say some stuff like that when I'd be writing about high school players, and they'd be like, oh, you're hyping it up. People are going to say mean things about that kid because you hyped him up and you wrote a nice article about him and put him on a pedestal, and now people are going to go at him and whatever and call him out on message boards. And I'm like, I'm not going to write a bad piece or not write a good piece about a kid because of what idiots are going to do on a message board or on Twitter. Like, I don't think we should cater to those people and dictate our content off of that. And this is just a more extreme version of that. I have a major issue with us deciding we're going to cater our content to the lowest common denominator of human beings and how they react to it.
I think that's fair. All right. That's probably good for this edition, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely. You've been listening to another edition of the Dan and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. For Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Zip them up.